You're listening to Jewish Talk, the podcast for the Jewish small communities and for anybody interested in Jewish culture and Jewish life. Hi, I'm Ed Horich, and I'm bringing you the second special episode from this year's Manchester Limud 2019. Last time we were deeply into the Kabbalah and specifically the texts of the Zohar. But this time we come bang up to date with something far more contemporary. We're talking film. I remember when I was a teenager making a special journey to the Big Smoke, to the city, to Manchester, to see just one film. 2001, A Space Odyssey. It made a lasting impression. And I associated that style of film with its director, Stanley Kubrick. Many of you will know that Stanley Kubrick made many more films, so many films, over so many decades. Spartacus, Paths of Glory, Doctor Strangelove, Barry Lyndon, The Shining, A Clockwork Orange, so many controversial and important films. The last film that he made was Eyes Wide Shut. He completed it, there were the final screenings before release, and he passed away. Now, although Stanley Kubrick was born in Manhattan in 1928 and brought up in the Bronx of Jewish parents, he didn't have a Jewish upbringing. So, join me in the audience at Manchester Limud 2019 to hear Professor of Film Studies Nathan Abrams explain why Eyes Wide Shut is Stanley Kubrick's most Jewish film.
Barada. Dayan. Good morning, as we say in Manchester. Right, that's Welsh for good morning. I suppose this is the wrong part of the North West. Liverpudlians might know this, it being the capital of North Wales. You'll look at me. I live in Bangor, North Wales. I'm a professor of film studies there. And if you're interested, another related project we're doing is a Jewish history of Bangor. And there's some free self-guided maps here and an app. And hopefully I'm working with Ed here about that. But anyway, why I'm here today is because since 2012, I have been working on Stanley Kubrick. You're familiar with Stanley Kubrick?
Yeah.
How many of you have seen Eyes Wide Shut?
Yeah.
Those of you who haven't, what brought you to this session?
It's a great film.
Yeah?
I've seen all the films.
Okay. Doctor Strangelove, yes, that is a great one. I can do equally this talk about Doctor Strangelove another time. But the reason why I'm doing Eyes Wide Shut is because it's the film's 20th anniversary this July. July 16th marks 20 years since the US release. It was Stanley Kubrick's final film and the film that he had pretty much completed before he died in March 1999. And also because I've just published this, Eyes Wide Shut, Stanley Kubrick in the making of his final film, which you can buy. The first people in the UK can actually buy a physical copy of this, which I'll sign if you're interested. I saw my previous speaker optimistically brought a suitcase with him. I hope that's for a UK tour. And my standard gag on this one is, although we claim to be the people of the book, we do not buy them. And to which you could reply, just not yours, Sonny, but, you know, next time. So just a bit of background. I started in Bangor in 2006 and developed a module on Stanley Kubrick. It took me between 2006 and 2011 before I realized there was something new to say about him. Kubrick is one of the most written about directors ever, if not the. I mean, it's either him or Hitchcock. And it's very hard to find a new angle. It took me 5 years of teaching it to realize he's Jewish. Well, I knew he was Jewish. But my point was, no one's really looked at this. One guy had, but mainly focused on The Shining and the Holocaust. And so what I've been doing since 2012 is exploring Stanley Kubrick's archive in detail and exploring his ethnicity. So before you ask me, yes, he was Jewish. Would he get into JFS? Yes, because his parents were Jewish, or whatever test you want to apply. Did he go to synagogue and believe in anything? No, right? I always get asked that question, how Jewish is? I think it's an unfair question, because if I went around this room, I think only one chap in here or two chaps are wearing a kippah, so the rest of you aren't Jewish, right? You know, whatever apply or we want to apply. No, because everyone always asks me that one, yep. But he was very culturally, ethnically, gastronomically, humorously Jewish. And that was, I published a book in 2018 called Stanley Kubrick, New York Jewish Intellectual, which got a very unfavorable review in your, I don't know if it's your employer, commentary. It's worth checking out. Frederick Raphael, who's the screenwriter, another Jewish person, I'll talk about this, for Eyes Wide Shut, tore me apart in commentary. But we had a little ding-dong. It was, but I expected it. It was fine. Anyway, I'm going to focus on this. I could talk about all his films. And in this title, what I've called this is Eyes Wide Shut, Stanley Kubrick's most Jewish film. And I'll explain why. I mean, in my book, I argue that all of Kubrick's films were Jewish, but beneath the surface. Yep. What I'm interested in when we teach film studies is not retreading the old familiar ground where we look at Woody Allen time and time again, or no doubt in a limud coming to you somewhere soon, there will be the three jazz singers talk. No offense if it's you who does it. But again, these are obvious films about Jewishness. Fiddler on the Roof, obviously. I've got nothing against these films. Yeah, the producers. Love them. But we know it's Jewish. It's obviously Jewish. I'm more interested in those films where we can read Jewishness into it. One, because there's a Jewish director, a Jewish source text, Jewish actors. If I was going to go even more extreme, I love those films where there's nothing Jewish about it whatsoever, and we can read Jewishness into it. And that's my little parlor trick, but I don't have time for that today. Now, this fills into that middle category. It's not Fiddler on the Roof. It's not a film in which there's no Jewishness whatsoever. It's one where there's a Jewish director, Jewish source text, key Jewish actor. And what I'm interested in, as I'll go through a little history of this, is how we can watch this film and understand or try to understand what Kubrick was doing and why he did it and why it's his most Jewish film, but not on the surface. Yep, does that make sense? Okay, good. So for those of you who haven't seen Eyes Wide Shut, just to take you back, this is based on a novella by Arthur Schnitzer that was published in English in 1926, or I think it was published in 1926, Traum Novella. It means dream story, and that's key, dream story. If you've watched the film or you're planning to watch the film, keep that title in mind. Kubrick discovered it, we're not sure, somewhere in the 40s, either through his dad, who was a cosmopolitan, well-read man, either through his dad's library, either through the classes he took at City College, New York, or audited at Columbia, I'm not sure, or through his second wife, Ruth Sobotka, who was Viennese, a Viennese immigrant herself, and very much part of the New York avant-garde art scene. So she might have introduced him. Anyway, what we know is Kubrick knew about Traum Novella in the early 50s, and right at the point at which his fiction filmmaking career began. Kubrick began making films, documentaries in 51, and began making fiction films in 53. And it was round about then, as he wanted to become a filmmaker, that he wanted to make Traum Novella. He failed until the mid-90s. This was a 40-year odyssey to bring this novel to screen, this novella to screen. Now, I don't know if any of you are familiar with Arthur Schnitzler. He deserves much more attention than we could give him in the West. Arthur Schnitzler is an interesting character, both in life and in fiction. He was trained as a doctor. But he's most well known as a playwright. He was a notorious philanderer. Here we'll get a little bit racy. Is alleged to have kept a diary of every orgasm he ever had, which you can go read in his archive. He was a companion, in a sense, to... he was a contemporary of Sigmund Freud. Sigmund Freud wrote to him and said, "I have never met you. Out of fear for meeting my doppelganger, I shall die." You know, is that idea? So Freud described him as his doppelganger. Freud said, "What you're doing in literature, I'm doing in neuropsychology, except you're doing it better than I am. Like, you're intuiting it, I'm actually having to do it clinically." So anyway, so he made this novel, he wrote this novel, and this novel is very much set in that kind of fin de siècle Viennese culture. And it's a very interesting, I went on holiday to Vienna last summer because I really, you know, it's a kind of forgotten empire. I don't know if any of you saw Simon Sebag Montefiore's three-parter on the Habsburgs. It's a kind of forgotten empire of Europe, but so much cultural importance. You know, Freud, Schnitzler, Hoffmannsthal, Bierhoffmann, Wittgenstein. At one point, Hitler, Trotsky, Stalin were all there at the same time. I mean, it was this center, Kafka. I could go on, Mahler, Mozart. I mean, all this culture that came out of Vienna, and we've kind of forgotten about it as being Viennese. That we think of those individuals. And Schnitzer was part of that. At the same time as this was a kind of Stefan Zweig, another one, as this was a kind of golden age of Jewish literature and cultural activity, it was also a highly anti-Semitic culture. Okay, I mean, Karl Luger, the anti-Semitic mayor of Vienna, Stanley Kubrick loved this definition of anti-Semitism. I'm getting quite partial to it. Is he defined anti-Semitism as hating Jews more than was strictly necessary. Okay, so this is the kind, he could say that openly. Karl Luger, the mayor of Vienna. So again, this is the culture out of which Hitler was nurtured. Yeah, there's no coincidence that that Hitler's kind of formative years were spent in Vienna. So what you've got on the one hand is a very assimilated middle class, culturally kind of blossoming Jewry on the one hand, and on the other hand, a highly anti-Semitic culture. And these two would have clashed, especially for those assimilated middle-class Jews like Freud, Schnitzler, Zweig. Yep, so that's the novella. And this novella is very interesting because it encapsulates a lot of these themes, and I'll unpack it as we watch the movie. So Kubrick spent 40 years trying to make this, finally found... So along the way, he wanted to have Woody Allen in the lead. That's our first hint that he wanted to keep the Jewishness of the story intact. That was back in the 70s. By the mid-90s, he found his screenwriter, Frederick Raphael. You might know about Frederick Raphael. He's a transplanted American to Europe, spends half his time between Britain and France. And just as Kubrick was a transplanted Jew living in Europe, another American, Frederick Raphael is well known for the Glittering Prizes, Two for the Road. Both as a novelist and a successful screenwriter. And it's very interesting that for this adaptation of Traumnovelle into Eyes Wide Shut, Kubrick chose a fellow transatlantic or transplanted Jewish writer to do it. Okay, that's our first clue to the extant Jewishness of it. Now, arguably, if you read Frederick Raphael's highly contentious memoir, Eyes Wide Open, it's a good piece of fiction, so I suggest reading it. He claims it's not fiction, by the way. That's a little joke in there. He said Kubrick wanted to erase every trace of Jewishness from the movie, right? So what we have is a very Jewish source novel. Hope you're with me here. Arthur Schnitzler, set in Fandasek of Vienna, about themes of assimilation, passing, sex, dreams, marriage, infidelity, envy within marriage. Arguably, one of the reasons it took him so long is you can't make a film about these things until you've been married for a significant period of time, right? Yeah? I mean, those of you who have the years under your belts or whatever the more inclusive metaphor would be, might be like, what's a young schnip doing telling us about something I've been enjoying for 50 years, right? So arguably, one of the little clues, Kubrick married his final wife and met and married his final wife at 57, married 58. So it took him almost 40 years to have something to say. The other thing to think about, right? Those of you familiar with Kubrick's films, he's done The End of the World in Dr. Strangelove. He's done The Future of Humanity in 2001. He's done Vietnam War set in London. Yeah? He puts spectacle on screen. He had the challenge of how do you put the most intimate drama of everyday life on the big screen? That's a difficult challenge, if you think about it. How do you translate the mundanity of marriage or thoughts of infidelity into a big screen spectacle? I'm not saying he's the first person to do it. You're right, lots of films look at this. What I'm trying to think is the context of his career. That if you've done 2001 and you've put the Earth on screen before people had seen it from space, because the man on the moon was the following year, that's a, you know, envisage that. And then, all right, how do I translate a man having a kind of breakdown because his wife's admitted an infidelity to him that she never had? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But thank you. Right, so let's get to some movie clips. So Kubrick comes to make this movie, and as I said, he wants to scrub all the Jewishness out of it. And what we have, he wanted to cast a real-life married couple. Here's the opening sequence. This is the couple he cast.
Honey, you see my wallet?
On the bedside table.
Now listen, you know we're running a little late.
I know. How do I look?
Perfect.
Is my hair okay?
It's great.
You're not even looking at it.
It's beautiful. You always look beautiful.
Did you give Roz the phone and pager numbers?
Yeah, I put it on the fridge.
So, huh?
Okay. All right. I'm ready.
Very clever, that. Notice that? It's a little thing in film studies. We talk about where the source of the music is, and there's two terms. There's diegetic, non-diegetic. Diegetic's when it emanates from somewhere within the world of the film, like speech. Right? Non-diegetic's when it comes from outside of the world of film, so like a soundtrack where there's no source. So this music starts off being non-diegetic, comes from outside the film, and then when he switches off the stereo, we realise it's playing from the stereo all along. Nice, clever little fiction Kubrick's playing on there. Haven't got time to go into that, because that's another talk. I mean, from a film studies perspective, it's beautiful. What you have to look is this is one continuous shot, right? Steadicam shot that goes on for about a minute, yeah? And then you've got this nice blue on the right there, and Kubrick lit his scene using what we call practicals. So he used lights within the scene, yeah? Natural lights that we might actually have, as opposed to extra filler. Anyway, so, do you know who those two are? Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. Jewish, not Jewish?
Not Jewish.
Of course not, right? So Bill and Fridolin in the novel, in the novella, are Jewish. Okay, it's hinted that they're Jewish. And suddenly we have Tom Cruise, Nicole Kidman. All right, this hits several things. One, Tom Cruise, big star. He was at the height of his career at this point. Yep, the Mission Impossible, that. And he gave up earning millions, which he could have commanded, to work on this movie for a fraction of that and spend the best part of about 3 years of their lives doing it. 18 months was the shoot, so it would have been almost 2 years, because of the importance of working with Kubrick. Kubrick wanted a real-life married couple. He considered the Baldwins and some others. He allotted on them. And he gave them the name Bill and Alice Harford. Okay? And he said, allegedly, to Frederick Raphael, please don't give them Jewish names, whatever you do, right? Give them something, and I quote now, give them something Harrison Ford Goyish. Okay, so you can see Harrison Ford, right? The irony is, if I was Lenny Bruce, you know, well, there's this talk on Lenny Bruce later, which I'll be at. Tom Cruise, Goyish, Harrison Ford, Jewish. So, although he named him after, said, give it Harrison Ford Goyish, he's actually a Jewish actor. Han Solo's Jewish, if you didn't know. And it also sounds like Hartford, where Kubrick lived in Hertfordshire, which, as we know, has a big Jewish population. So there's little hints, maybe, beneath the surface there's something more going on. We also have, did you hear the music? Yeah, which was?
Shostakovich.
What kind of music?
It's a waltz,
yeah. So again, a little hint back to Vienna, and the era of the original novel. But interestingly, he didn't use a Viennese waltz. He did that in 2001 with the Blue Danube. Okay. Here he uses a waltz composed by a Russian during the Stalinist troubles. So interesting. It's just one of the ways Kubrick plays around with us. He doesn't always pick the obvious. And we have an establishing shot of a Central Park West apartment modelled on the apartment. The interior was modelled on the apartment where the Kubricks lived in the 60s. So again, all these little Jewish hints and traces, and the apartment is this picture you see there in the middle is by his wife. She's not Jewish. In fact, she's the niece of V. Harlan, the notorious anti-Semitic filmmaker who did the film Yud Sus, which is interesting in of itself, but that's another talk. So we get these little Jewish Viennese traces running through the movie. I'm just going to fast forward a bit.
He plays pretty good for a dog.
I'll just mute this. So they're invited to this party by a wealthy New York businessman called Victor Ziegler, okay, played by Sidney Pollack. Sidney Pollack we're going to meet him in a minute, is a very well-known Jewish actor. You'll know him as the agent in Tootsie. He directed Tom Cruise in The Firm in 1993. It's one of the reasons why Tom Cruise got this job, is because Pollack and Kubrick were friends, and Pollack recommended Kubrick. Cruise to Kubrick, and then told Cruise, Kubrick's going to approach you to do this movie. Don't ask too many questions. Don't screw it up, because you'll get this job unless you ask too many questions. So I thought it was an interesting comment. So what we have here is, so this character here is Nick Nightingale. He's a Jewish character in the novel. He's a Galician Jew. I'm part Galiciana. You know the old thing about Galicianas, Bill doesn't know it, that when you shake a Galiciana's hand, when you take it back, you count how many fingers you've got. All right, Bill doesn't know this one. This is Bill's doppelganger. So another little clue, there might be something Jewish. This is played by Todd Field, not Jewish. So it's another way that Kubrick's translated the source novel into something a bit less Jewish. And here we have this Hungarian lounge lizard, Zsándor Szávost, who very much is a character out of Zweig, who's attempting to seduce Alice, knowing full well she's married. And he's again this kind of harking back to this Viennese era. And if you look at the lights behind, any of you have any, see any connections with the Viennese connection? This kind of harks to the paintings of Schiele and Klimt. You know, that kind of, you think the kiss, that wall of light, those curtains of light. So you get nice little hints back to that kind of Viennese Jewish culture. Right, sorry, there's going to be a bit of nudity here.
Exactly. Are we going?
Now, another little clue to, I think, this being Jewish is they changed the timing of the movie. Yeah? So it's Carnival in Vienna, and here they've changed it to Christmas. And so everywhere is suffused with Christmas lights. Okay, there was an advantage to this. It was another use of practicals. It enabled you to light the scene by putting more light into the scene. But it makes me think, right, if you're making a book about Jewish passing, assimilation, alienation, and an anti-Semitic culture, what better time to set it than Christmas? To quote the great sages of South Park, I'm a Jew, a lonely Jew at Christmas. So again, that Christmas time setting. The interesting thing is this is set in New York City, right, Christmas. What might we expect to see? What would we expect to see at New York City around the holiday season, in addition to Christmas lights, given New York's population?
Hanukkah.
Exactly. Not one menorah in the entire movie. Okay? Which, again, would not be factually correct for a director who's known to be factually correct and to go to the extra length to add the detail in. Okay, so we have this character now, Victor Ziegler. Victor Ziegler is very interesting. Victor Ziegler was invented by Raphael and Kubrick and was nowhere in the original novel. He's there as a kind of guiding paternal figure who later on explains the plot. Okay, what's going on? Originally, he had Harvey Keitel cast, okay, as this character. This is the house. Yes, well done. Did any of you know that? How many of you knew Harvey Keitel was Jewish? Yeah, see? And how many of you definitely didn't know he was Jewish? Okay, so Harvey Keitel was originally cast. Well, I mean, what are your associations of Harvey Keitel? Why do you think?
Two Italian mafias.
Exactly, exactly. I watched Pulp Fiction the other night, a film Kubrick admired, and a film that he asked Frederick Raphael to watch. And interestingly, because the title, Eyes Wide Shut, where did that title come from? We don't know. It's an oxymoron. How can you have your eyes wide shut? But there's a little line in Pulp Fiction where he says, my eyes are effing wide open. And I was thinking, yeah, maybe that provided some influence. Anyway, Winston Wolfe, that's a character in Pulp Fiction that we think of. He's doing the insurance adverts. I don't know if you have them on the channels you listen to on the radio. Yeah? I hear them all on Absolute Radio. So he plays that kind of wise guy. So had that been Harvey Keitel, who I would argue most people don't recognize that he's Jewish, he is, but don't recognize him as Jewish on screen, it would give a different meaning to this sequence, okay? But here we have Sidney Pollack, recognizably Jewish actor, director, in a sequence where a prostitute he's had sex with, we presume, is overdosed in. Look at this bathroom. It's another clue to the Jewishness. This bathroom is bigger than most New York apartments.
Had a little accident here.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. I mean, when we see Sidney Pollack there, what jumped out at you about Sidney Pollack? So this is an interesting thing about, is this film Jewish, is it not film Jewish? At its heart, the most clearly evil character, okay, is this Victor Ziegler character, okay, played by a Jewish, recognizably Jewish actor-director. And most of the criticism of this film is centered that if there's an evil character in the film, it's him, okay? And it's the things that your eye is drawn to, what did you notice most about him? Well, the interesting thing, if you look at the artwork on the walls of these naked women, one, Ziegler treats women like objects, okay? Both in terms of art, and he's using the prostitute like an object. And if we watch the whole scene, he can't get her out there quick enough. Yeah, he's not concerned for her welfare per se. He's concerned for his welfare about being caught upstairs. He's a married man. Yeah, we've met his wife downstairs. At a party in which there's an overdosing prostitute. That's what he said. Can we get her out of here as quickly as possible? Okay. And he summons Bill like a plumber to fix a problem. Okay, so that shows his power, his wealth, his status in society, but also how he treats women. Okay, so it's not a positive portrait. Secondly, when we first meet him, we see him topless. What's the things you notice about him? So he's hairy. What else? What are the other features we see?
Zipping up.
He's zipping up. The interesting thing is again, it makes you wonder what's happening between why he's zipping up only now and she's probably passed out earlier.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're not getting a nice picture of this character, okay, played by a Jewish actor-director, who's her suit, which is a Jewish characteristic, like a stereotypical Jewish characteristic. He wears glasses, another stereotypical characteristic, yes? He doesn't cover her up, he covers himself up, but not her up. Yeah, nice point. See, this is what I love about Stanley Kubrick, right? I've been teaching this film since 2007. I've written a book on it, and you still have things to learn. Very few films sustain this level of ability to read new interpretations. What I find interesting, at the heart of this movie, the movie's Heart of Darkness, is a Jewish character. We can assume is Jewish. Actually, I know he's Jewish, because in the archive, in the notes for translators and dubbers, he's described as rich Jewish businessman 50. Something to think about. Yeah, why did Kubrick put an actor-director in there, make him Jewish? But he's the one who's... Every canard, anti-Jewish stereotypical canard about Jews and sex, Jews and perversion, Jews corrupting Gentile Christian women, yep, and this has gone through the ages, is summarised in this sequence. Very interesting. Something to reflect upon. The other little nods to Jewishness are the toilets, the bathrooms, yeah? You need to read my new Jew in Film in 2012, the final chapter, where I argue, successfully hopefully, that by and large in film and television, particularly US film and television, the bathroom is semiotically coded as Jewish space. Yep, the number of Jews that occur in bathrooms, yeah, suggests that there is a link. I mean, there is in Jewish culture, right? We're one of the few cultures who have a prayer to thank God for having opened us and closed us, so that we can function. We are one of the few cultures where you are born a pisher and you die an alter kaka. Right? Your life cycle is coded going from a number one to a number two. Yeah? We have Philip Roth. All kinds of literature reflecting on the bathroom. You read Portnoy's Complaint, that pretty much takes place in the bathroom, especially the early sections. I wonder if Ed's editing, censoring this for his small communities. Eventually. Oh, he's getting this bit out. Best bit, Ed. And I would argue it is a halakha, a rule of Jewish culture, that at least one male member of the family, typically male, must suffer from a stomach-related condition like irritable bowel syndrome, or what my wife calls hers is furious bowel syndrome. It must be discussed at length at the dinner table. Right? And of course, the bit in Portnoy's Complaint is Portnoy is going into the bathroom to masturbate, but telling his father he has diarrhea, and his father, who has constipation, is just full of jealousy for Portnoy because he can go where he can't. Anyway, so, and the other thing is, how would you characterize the taste of this bathroom?
Decadent.
Decadent, yeah, that's a good one. I was looking for one word, vulgar. Vulgar. One of the things, Norman Podoretz, erstwhile editor of Commentary magazine, said, Jews are accused of vulgarity, not least by Jews themselves. Okay, so, Jewish taste, tchotchkes, right? I find this like an upmarket version of Jewish vulgarity. Little clue, I think, Kubrick's giving. Anyway, as we move on to the movie, so this chap in the bed there who's just recently passed is Lou Nathanson, okay? So again, I'm a Nathan. Suggestion that might be a Jewish character, that certainly a lot of Bill's patients are going to be Upper West Side Jews. And at least later on, we hear a couple of Jewish names when he's cancelling some appointments. So this is what I want you to watch. So what I love about this movie is Kubrick famously didn't fly anywhere, okay? So how do you not fly anywhere and then shoot a movie in New York? Well, originally, we're going to shoot the whole thing on location in London. That proved unworkable. So what they did is they built a backlot set at Pinewood. So a lot of this is all backlot. A lot of what we see, these exterior shots of New York, are and a back lot of pine wood combined with some second unit footage of Bill walking. And I think it's done in such a way that you don't really notice. Let me just so you know, right, in between the party, they go to work, the next night, they're getting high, and they get into a conversation, and it turns into an argument between Alice and Bill. Alice admits to Bill that she once had a fantasy whilst they're on holiday about leaving him and their daughter, right, for a naval officer she didn't even know, right? And she said, if he had wanted it, then I would have given you and Alice up for him, which I think is a really devastating, yeah? Not so much that she would leave him, okay? I mean, that's one thing. For me, it's really devastating to his ego. Well, it is anyway, but that she would give up her daughter as well for a naval officer she didn't even know. Okay, go ahead.
Sorry, it's been a while since I've seen the film, but didn't she just mean like for one night?
No, forever.
Was it forever?
Yeah, yeah. I interpret it as forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I interpret it as forever. Anyway, Bill then goes on this nighttime odyssey. So this argument sparks the plot, and during which he imagines this liaison that never happened between the naval officer and his wife, Alice. What Kubrick did very cleverly is he made sure Bill was not on set when these sequences were shot, right? To create some psychological drama in the actor. Well, what's going on with my wife and the other actor when I'm not there? Yeah, very clever. He manipulated his actors in such a way to produce the desired performances. So this is Bill walking down the street, imagining, and then this happens. Right, I don't know if you can tell, right? Just to point this out, because I love this. That shot before he turned the corner, before the cut, is second unit footage. So Bill is walking on a running machine, which they had to adjust because Tom Cruise is small, right? To make him look the height they wanted him to, and the speed, but with back projection of New York streets. And then when he turns the corner, this is a set. Yeah? This is nothing to do with Jewishness. I'm just trying to point out the artistry of the guy, because that's a lot what I deal with as well. Anyway, it's what's happening next.
Taking a walk.
There we go. So second unit. So you can't see his feet.
No,
it's on a running machine. There, that edit. On. This is the back lot. But more than you could before.
Hey, what team's this switch hitter playing for?
Looks like the pink team,
this
huh?
Faggot.
Faggot.
Merry Christmas, Mary.
Hey, my brothers are back there. Prime cut of meat, baby.
You want to take a ride in this fight, Kelly, you stupid faggot?
It's like you got a moon puncher going on here, huh?
You standing so close. Get out of here.
I got dumps that are bigger than you.
Come on, Macho Man. Come on, Macho Man. You want a piece of this?
So this is very loaded with meaning, this sequence. In the novel, in the novella, Bill runs into an anti-Semitic fraternity. Okay? So clearly, for those of you familiar with the source novel, we know this is an anti-Semitic encounter. But Kubrick turns it to one of homophobia. But as those of you who know your history and your film history and your cultural studies, Jews and homosexuals have been very closely linked. Jewish men have been called homosexual and even said to menstruate. Jews, Sontag's Notes on Camp talks about Jews and gays. And if there's a film called Crossfire in 1947, probably the first post-war film about anti-Semitism made by Hollywood, it was based on a novel called The Brick Foxhole, in which it's not about anti-Semitism, it's about homophobia. So that novel flipped it one way, Kubrick flips it back the other way. You with me? So, and he would have known his film. So what we have, although this is an anti-Semitic incident, the way in which it plays out, for those who know this stuff, can read that parallel between homophobia and anti-Semitism. Did anyone notice what sweatshirts they were wearing? What uni? You're right. Anyone know which one? Want to take some guesses? On the big screen, you'll notice this. There you go, you see it there. Go on.
Yale.
Yeah. Now, Yale, again, significant. Not only is it Ivy League, but it's the university most notorious for operating anti-Jewish quotas up until the Second World War. By which, you know, you didn't say Jews aren't allowed. You just said we're only going to take 5% of 1939 intake from Brooklyn. All right, I'm from the Bronx. Okay, so again, for those who know their American Jewish history and know these things, the choice of Yale is highly significant. And you could have said, oh, well, it's going to be Yale, but Yale's not in New York. It's not far. But it could have been NYU. It could have been Columbia. Yep, it could have been CCNY. It could have been any number of New York universities. There's loads of them there. So for those who know the codes, very interesting. So again, another little hint, I would say. Right, let me just pause it. If he hasn't already been emasculated by Alice's revelations, hence that imagining and punching his fist, right? Well, I think it's a very interesting punch, because is he punching himself because Alice would have cheated on him, or is he punching himself because he's dreaming about it? And look at the way he's constructed the naval officer in his head. But when we go around the corner, so Bill's feeling emasculated. Sorry, the reason I want to mention that, Jewish men are often in history characterized as emasculated, unfit for war, unfit for sport, that kind of thing, particularly in Central Europe. Let's see, Christmas signs everywhere. Second unit footage.
Excuse me.
We'll just let this play.
Do you know what time it is?
2:12.
Going anywhere special?
No, I'm just taking a walk.
I'd just like to have a little fun.
I'm sorry.
Have a little fun? I just live right down there. Would you like to come inside with me?
Right. Can you read that?
Yeah.
Yeah, do you see what that is? Right, Knishery. And that says bagels. Okay, this is an entirely constructed set. Yep, Kubrick built this backward set, backlot set, and asked for this to be constructed. So this is the village. Okay, so the village during the 20s, 30s, 40s is the kind of bohemian, well, 30s, 40s, 50s, bohemian capital of New York, right? And a lot of the people who wrote for Commentary and all the other Jewish intellectual magazines sort of came out of this bohemian intellectual village culture. So straight away, the village has Jewish connotations as well as homosexual connotations as his village people. Anyway, Kubrick asked for this to be constructed. This is based on a real-life place called Jonah Schimmel's Knishery on Houston, which isn't in the village, it's right on the border. Okay, so very interestingly, he asked for the type of place that he frequented in his youth to be exactly reconstructed. And if you look at pictures of this and you look at pictures of Jonah Schimmel, it's the same. He's just changed the name to Joseph Kreibisch, Joseph K. Yeah? Which reminds us of Kafka. Okay, again, another Austro-Hungarian Empire author of which Kubrick was a huge fan. And it's very significant that he decides to put this little Jewish landmark in there. It's the only extant Jewish thing in the entire film. And I'm trying to think why. And I've spoken to people who did the locations, and they said, because he was going on his memory. It was a nostalgia trip for him. He hadn't been back to New York since the 60s. And he wanted the sorts of places he used to frequent revisited. But most of them are now gone. Okay? There's another interesting thing here. Knish, right, is a significant Jewish product. Okay? Somehow didn't make its way to Western Europe in the way in the United States. But Knish is a recognizably Jewish symbol, like a bagel used to be. So if I look there at that picture and think, oh, there's a Jewish breakfast minion at this school, which is not a Jewish school, is it? But I see those bagels. That just means breakfast, right? To us, it means Jewish, right? Knish, there's no other interpretation. The other thing about Knish is, if you read your Leo Rostam, there's two interpretations of Knish. One, he has the brains of a Knish. Yep, which Bill certainly does. And the second one is, are you looking for some knish? The sort of lady here on the left, her name's Domino. That might be what a Jewish maidler might offer a customer, some knish. So there's vulgar connotations there. So there's an interesting little hints here of Kubrick dropping Jewishness into this. Okay, go ahead.
Is there a reason for the number on the shop? Is it created?
Yeah, what have we got? 289, 269?
269.
Well, there you go.
I know, but I don't want to go the obvious. Is there a significance?
It's very interesting you ask me that one, because there is a lot of gematria, right, and numerology with Kubrick's work. Fine. Yeah? There's room 237 in The Shining. There's lots of sevens. Jeffrey Cox has done a whole book where he argues multiples of seven increments of evil leading up to 42, 42 being the final solution, right? The Wannsee Conference and the final solution. So is there a significance to the number? The fans will say there is. Did Kubrick mean there to be? Probably not. But then again, he might have thought, well, let's put 269 in there. Yeah? Nice little pun. He had that kind of twinkle in his eye. So it's quite possible. Right, I'll show you one final sequence because we're running out of time. So Bill infiltrates his way into the sort of place where he doesn't belong. This is Somerton, okay? This is Luton Hoo in north of London. Bill has to disguise himself to infiltrate into the sort of upper class setting where he doesn't belong. Look at all these limos, right? He arrives in a cab, okay? So clearly he's an interloper, right? An outsider, a stranger in a strange land where he doesn't belong. And he has to hide under a mask and cape in order to get inside. This is, I think, one of the greatest sequences ever shot for cinema, and not because of its nudity.
Good evening. That's what it's
called. Fidelio. See, Fidelio, that reference to the only opera that, was it Beethoven did? So harking back to that, was it Mozart? I think it was Mozart. Harking back to that culture. So Bill infiltrates this strange ritual, okay, that looks like a Catholic mass, presided over by an inquisitor type. I have to talk over it just for, got 9 minutes left. Yeah. So we have this Torquemada figure presiding over this kind of inverted mass. But remember, this is the product of the minds of three Jews, Schnitzler, Raphael, and Kubrick. This is their idea of what they get up to. Yeah? So I've spoken to some of the people in this circle and the person who shot it and all this. That's another talk, but you can find that out in there. Well, it's interesting. This is Jocelyn Pook, right, who's a British composer. And this is called Backwards Priest. And she's got a Romanian priest's liturgy and has run it backwards. And we're meant to believe it's coming from his mouth, but it's not. We're meant to believe he's playing this on the keyboards. But there are no wires, and a keyboard wouldn't create this sound. Yes, so that's Nachtigal, the Jewish musician in the original novella. I'm just going to fast forward. So Bill's been wandering through this mansion where he doesn't belong. Have you seen Barry Lyndon? Yeah, Barry Lyndon is about, again, I'd read that as a Jewish story. Barry Lyndon is about an odyssey or a picaresque story where this man tries to make it in the upper class English society and fails, right? And gets ejected, and in doing so loses his leg, right? And as one critic said, what more Jewish story is there than that? Where Barry manages over several, you know, years, Bill can't even last one night. Okay. And we'll just watch what happens. So Nick Nightingale's being led out. I'll explain. Listen to that music. This is Ligeti. Jewish. Composed during the Stalinist regime of terror. He envisaged each hit of that key to be a knife plunging into Stalin's heart.
May I have the password, please?
Fidelio.
That's right, sir. That is the password for admittance. But may I ask, what is the password for the house?
The password for the house.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I seem to have forgotten it.
That's unfortunate. Because here, it doesn't matter whether you have forgotten it or if you never knew it. You will kindly remove your mask.
Again, this story is loaded with Jewish meaning. He's infiltrating in a society where he's trying to pass, and he's found out and he's exposed. Okay? That is the fear of Jews in Western civilized society. That is what motivated Freud to write. If you read the subtext of Freudian analysis, it's about being afraid of being uncovered when you're trying to pass as Jewish. The other thing, specifically being asked to undress, yeah, I mean, in the context of 20th century history, that's very rich with Jewish meaning. That's as much of Tom Cruise you're going to see. Tom Cruise, you would have seen stripped to his boxer shorts in the scene where he's arguing with Alice. So if you want to rewatch it, that's where it is. But I think the idea of being asked to strip in a 20th century... Yeah, to expose the primary marker of your Jewishness is very symbolic. Anyway, we've run out of time, so just to wrap up, what I've hopefully introduced you here is Kubrick took this sort of Jewish novel, scrubbed it clean, supposedly, for by the time it got to the big screen. Why? Because Kubrick was a commercial mainstream director who didn't want to alienate his audiences by making Jewish stories. Okay, and that's possibly... But even in doing so, I would say you can't scrub a text like that clean of its Jewishness. He inserted a kind of subsurface Jewishness through the casting of characters like Victor Siegler, through the homophobic incident, through the Knishery, and there's lots of moments like this, so that when people could read the clues, they understood this as a Jewish film. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Now, I'm sure you're going to have to rush off and rewatch or watch for the first time Eyes Wide Shut and see what all those references are about. It's a long time since I watched it, and I've been catching up with some clips on YouTube. And no doubt you'll be interested in the book that Nathan Abrams has co-authored. It's Eyes Wide Shut, Stanley Kubrick and the Making of His Final Film. It's available in all good bookshops and online, of course, and we've got a link to it on the JSCN website. Just go to jscn.org.uk, and if you can't see it on the front page, then use our little search facility to just Google Stanley Kubrick and you'll come up with it straight away. Well, that's it for this special edition, and if you enjoyed it or any of the other episodes in our series, please do give them 5-star ratings. A positive review would be very helpful, and it helps other people find us. It really makes a difference. Next time, it's another special edition, our third in our series, and it's a special edition indeed because it's the Jewish Small Community Session from Manchester Linwood 2019. I'm talking to Claudia, I'm talking to Mike, and I'm talking to Nathan as well. We'll be talking about the Jewish heritage of Wales to three people with a lot of expertise. Join me for some fascinating insights into small Jewish communities in Wales next time on Jewish Talk. I'm Ed Horwich. This has been the podcast for the Jewish Small Communities.